I hope your day is going well, and this is Pat, and I'm reading from the Clinton Journal of February the 13th. The county addresses state compliance for solar ordinance. Gordon Woods reporting. Members of the County Board Land Use Committee this week again addressed how to bring the county's solar energy ordinance into compliance with the state statute. I think all we can consider right now is what changed in the statute, said committee member and county board president Joe Witt. And if our ordinance doesn't comply, we would make a recommended change to the ordinance. Land use chairman Buck Carter advised reviewing the county's solar ordinance changes. Changes that would be made by our ordinance that we might suggest how to make them, Carter said. The state prohibits jurisdictions from enhancing solar and wind energy ordinances that could be interpreted as more restrictive than state regulations. As I see it, most of them are pretty simple to come back into compliance to where the state was, Carter said. The committee was provided with a sample ordinance, but Witt was concerned the sample might not be entirely applicable to DeWitt County. They may have things in their sample that comply with the statute, but have nothing to do with our ordinance, so we can't consider those, Witt asked. I think what we can consider is the statute. What does it say, and does our ordinance comply? Witt said he wasn't suggesting they ignore the sample, but just because there are some things in the sample we would like, if it's not in the statute, it would have to go through the hearing process. All we can do is retrofit our ordinance with what's in the statute, he said. Witt said changes to bring the county ordinance into compliance with state statute would not require a hearing. Zoning Administrator Elizabeth Weichel also pointed out that the county would now be required to handle community solar projects under much the same criteria as commercial solar facilities. So we are going to have to rework that whole section so it reads more like commercial, Weichel said. She and Witt said the RPC already had begun to address that. In additional business, in her zoning report, Weichel said she issued 12 building permits in January. This included one new residence. She said the Zoning Board of Appeals, ZBA, withdrew the text amendment for commercial solar battery storage so the Regional Planning Commission could address it. She said the RPC also planned to work on updating the community solar energy ordinance. Carter also touched on the growing number of counties looking to ban large data centers from their jurisdictions. Data centers use vast amounts of water to cool their facilities. The centers can strain or deplete local fresh water supplies, particularly in water-stressed areas. Walkers bring Walker Tire back to Clinton. Katie O'Grady Pine reporting. Effective Monday, February the 2nd, One Stop Auto Center returned to the Walker Tire. David and Sandy Maxwell, along with their children Wyatt Maxwell and his wife Jess, approached One Stop Auto owners about buying back the business. Spokesperson Sean Horvey said the Maxwell family had nothing but praise for the One Stop owners for their work with the business over the past year, as well as their graciousness and willingness to allow the family to buy back the business. Walker Tire will retain all the services One Stop Auto offered, including a lube bay, mechanic work, exhaust, and tires. Walker Tire originally opened in 1935. The business will be managed by David and Wyatt. Independent banker recognizes Longview Capital Corporation, Newman, Illinois. Longview Capital Corporation received recognition in the January 2026 issue of Independent Banker magazine for its work in providing free medical, dental, and vision care to Illinois residents. The article highlighted Longview's partnership with Remote Area Medical and the clinic held at Paris High School in June 2025. The project included teams from Longview Bank, Longview Community Bank, Federated Bank, and Middletown Bank. Staff members, volunteers, and local health care providers supported the two-day clinic. The Longview Foundation funded lodging, meals, and other needs for the remote area medical personnel. The event served 185 individuals and delivered services valued at more than $100,000. LCC pledged support for follow-up care for patients with ongoing medical needs. The company is preparing for another clinic June 13th through 14th, 2026 at Paris High School. Giving back to the communities we serve is at the heart of Longview Capital Corporation, said David Albin, President and Chairman of LCC. Access to basic health care should never depend on a person's circumstances, and through this partnership, we are proud to help remove barriers and bring essential medical, dental, and vision care directly to our neighbors. This recognition reflects the dedication of our employees, volunteers, and healthcare partners who make this mission possible. Longview Community Bank of Clinton is part of the Longview Capital Corporation. Hands-on Workshop offers practical guidance for pruning fruit trees, Decatur, Illinois. Understanding the three W's of fruit tree pruning can lead to healthier trees and better yields. Explore the why, when, and how of proper pruning at a hands-on workshop led by University of Illinois Extension Master Gardeners. Fruit tree pruning demonstrations are scheduled for several dates and times in February and March. All demonstrations will be at the Crossing Healthcare Garden, 320 Central Avenue in Decatur. February 20th, 1 to 4, February 21st, 10 to 2, March the 5th, 1 to 4, and March the 6th, 10 to 2. Our Master Gardener volunteers will demonstrate proper pruning techniques, and everyone will have an opportunity to practice hands-on pruning using the many trees in the orchard at Crossing Healthcare Garden, said Horticulture Program Coordinator Whitney Allison. This is an outdoor workshop. Participants should dress for the weather and bring gloves and pruning tools if available. Registration is accepted up to one day before the event at go.illinois.edu/fruit tree. University of Illinois Extension provides equal opportunities in programs in employment. And from the op-ed page, A Dog That Changed Everything, from the Mac Desk by Billy McMacken. When I'm home, this dog is pretty much attached to me. Room to room, chair to chair. If I stand up, he stands up. If I sit down, he's already there, curled in close like it's the most natural thing in the world. Max doesn't need a leash when I'm home. He's already exactly where he wants to be. This is new for us. We were not a dog family before we moved to Illinois. Not even close. Dogs were something other people had. Something required schedules, fences, training, and patience we weren't sure we possessed. We admired them from a distance, nodded politely at neighbors on walks, and went on with our lives. Then Max showed up and quietly changed the rules. Max is a 2-year-old Cavalier King Charles Spaniel with a big heart and a nervous streak to match. He is most definitely a high-anxiety dog. He hates crates with a passion usually reserved for mail carriers. Fireworks are a hard no. Thunderstorms, also no. If the sky starts making noise, Max is suddenly convinced the world is ending and that one of us, preferably me, should be doing something about it. But Max didn't just attach himself to me. He captured everyone. Even Carly, and she was the most skeptical of all. The realist, the one who asked the practical questions and made it clear that this was not going to become a house ruled by a dog. Yet somehow, quietly and without asking permission, Max won her over. The same dog she once questioned now has a reserved spot next to her on the couch. Our 10-year-old daughter, Kendall? The fun she and Max have together, oh my, chasing, laughing, whispering secrets, inventing games that only the two of them understand. If joy had a soundtrack, it would sound like those two tearing through the house. And then there's Camden, 12. He's a boy, living mostly in his own world, as boys that age tend to do. He doesn't seek Max out all the time, and he'd never admit to needing him. But on his own terms, when no one's watching, he'll sit with Max, scratch behind his ears, and let the dog lean in close. That counts for everything. Dogs take up an unreasonable amount of space in our hearts for creatures that don't say a word. They don't offer advice. They don't solve problems. They don't make anything easier, except everything. They show up every day, same enthusiasm, same loyalty, same belief that you are, without question, their person. We didn't plan on becoming a dog family, but Max didn't ask for permission. He just showed up, stayed close, and claimed his space. Honestly, I can't imagine the house without him now, and I don't think any of us would want to try. Billy McMacken is the owner of Max and the Normalite newspaper group. And another op-ed, Television Bliss, the On Point column by Richard Koritz. My wife and I have been married for 55 years. For a marriage to last, the parties need to learn to compromise and adapt to the other's wants and needs. Control of the television is a point of conflicts in many marriages. We have multiple televisions, but the one television that seems to be the point of conflict is in the bedroom. My wife is very patient with this old guy and normally doesn't complain when I watch Fox or CNN news in the bedroom. She tends to read a book in the living room or engage in some sewing project in her sewing room. Life is peaceful, and we seem to have managed to keep the marriage going. However, there are two broadcasting events for which my wife asserts her controlling interest in that television set in the bedroom. New Year's Eve and the Olympic figure skating. Come New Year's Eve, that remote is in her hand. Should I dare touch it or suggest something else to view, I am simply directed to sit still and be quiet. She has her snacks all made up and is prepared to watch that ball drop in New York City at midnight. I'm thinking it's a well-lit ball that is going to be lowered at midnight. So what? The time will change, and I will have to remember a new month and year, but who cares? She cares. We watch the activities across several venues in the country on the TV, but she is always watching that ball up in the air, waiting for it to drop at the stroke of midnight. I don't care. All I see is a couple of guys on NBC over the years who are broadcasting having a few too many. Not her. She waits for the ball to drop. This year I fell asleep a half hour before the ball dropped. My wife thinks I have no interest in this annual rite of passage. She is correct. But let her watch it to her heart's desire, as it maintains television bliss. Currently, it is the Winter Olympics in Italy. The Olympics occur in both of the summer and winter at four-year intervals in different countries around the world. I truly appreciate having the best athletes in the world perform in a non-political forum. I admit I enjoy watching the ski and snowboard events with some chips and a soda, but I am not consumed by the events. Figure skating for me is even less consuming. Not so my fanatical wife. Olympic figure skating brings out the manic personality in my wife. She loves watching the sport, especially the performances by couples on the skating rink. She marvels at their grace and athleticism. That remote is in her hand, and if I even look at it, her death stare is withering. If I want some chips and soda, I can meekly go to the kitchen and get it myself. I may try to ingratiate myself with her by asking if she would like anything, but she doesn't acknowledge me. She is watching Speed and Grace on the skating rink and could care less about some old guy going after a snack. She is in television bliss, and I had best leave her alone. The Olympics will last another week. Perhaps then I can get back to my Fox News and she to her evening reading and sewing. We've made it 55 years, and I can probably last another week. On a more serious note, the country is facing another partial government shutdown at the end of the week. Congress is elected to assure that services are provided to citizens. Maybe if Congress were to lose some of its frills and paychecks, Congress would pay attention to the everyday American. Right now, Congress appears to be run, and I'm referring to both parties, by a bunch of first graders who only have one ball for recess and haven't figured out how to play the game. Where are the adults? Richard Corrix is an Illinois native, attorney, and former DeWitt County State's attorney. And now for some sports. Clinton earns third place finish at Class 3A State Tournament. El Paso. Clinton's 7th grade boys basketball team delivered an impressive showing at the Class 3A State Tournament hosted by El Paso Gridley High School, finishing third in the state. Clinton opened tournament play at 40-37 victory over Bradley Central in the first round to advance to the state semifinals. In the semifinals, Clinton faced eventual state champion Tutopolis, which pulled away for a 55-27 win and sent Clinton to the third-place game. Clinton responded with a strong performance in the third-place contest, defeating LaSalle Lincoln 42-28 to secure a state trophy and cap its run among the state's elite. Bison Snow led Clinton's scoring during the tournament with 33 points, followed by Jack Nichols with 26. Kason Reynolds, Weston Ferguson, and Briggs Dubois each added 11 points as Clinton showcased balanced scoring throughout its state tournament run. Tutopolis captured the state championship with a 48-43 win over Lyle in the title game. Clinton wrapped up its season with a 23-5 record and third-place finish in the Class 3A. Maroons 18-6 with big win over Vikings. Mark Rogers reporting. On Friday, January 30th, the hometown Clinton Maroons hosted the Tri-Valley Vikings on the Gene Vance Court. Outside it was cold, but the basketball arena heated up quickly. The Maroons got the tip-off and proceeded to liven up the evening with 3 3-point buckets from Keaton Graves, along with other players chipping in for a 15-6 run in the first quarter. This set the Vikings on their heels. The speedy movement and passing of Maroons had the Vikings' tall men spinning. The second quarter was closer, but the Maroons kept their lead and added to it for a 22-3 score at the halftime break. Coming out of the half, both teams adjusted their strategies, with the opposition coming out on top in the third quarter, gaining back 4 points. However, Coach Vic Binkley made some adjustments on the fly, rounding out the third quarter and at the beginning of the final stanza to begin to poke more holes in the Vikings' sinking ship. The fourth quarter saw the Maroons go on a 19-11 tear, wrapping it up with a 63-48 win. This gives the Maroons an 18-6 overall record and 3-0 in the conference play, while Tri-Valley falls to 9-10 overall. The home team was led by Keaton Graves with 30 points, including his first quarter three three-pointers. He was followed by Jaden Bell with 13 points and Keaton Daughtry with 10 points, including 2 3-pointers of his own. The Vikings had one player in double figures, freshman guard Mason Messenmore, with 13 points. The Lady Maroons, 5-0 in conference, with 77-37 over Raiders. The team continues a 20-game winning streak. Mark Rogers reporting. The hometown Lady Maroons continue their basketball dominance over the non-conference and conference games. On Thursday, February the 5th, the Lady Maroons hosted the Central A&M Lady Raiders on Gene Vance Court. The Lady Maroons wasted no time in setting the tone of the evening, taking a 27-7-point lead in the first quarter. As overwhelming as the score was, the Lady Raiders didn't buckle totally. They held their own during this quarter, dropping only 2 more points to the home team. At halftime, Lady Maroons were up substantially, 42-20. If the opposition had any hopes of continuing their comeback, they were dashed in the third quarter as the home team went on a 19-10 run to end the third stanza of the game up 61-30. The Lady Maroons then sealed the game in the fourth by holding the visitors to 7 points while producing 16 points of their own for the 77-37 win. The Lady Maroons are now 27-4 overall and 5-0 in conference play, assuring themselves first place in the conference. The Lady Raiders fall to 4-20 overall and 0-5 in conference play. The Lady Maroons were led by Carly Anderson with 20 points, followed by Lila Clover and Avery Smith with 17 points each, and Clara Dempsey with 11 points. The Lady Maroons scored 7 3-point shots during the game. The Lady Raiders were led by Kylie Sneerly with a game high of 21 points and was the only Lady Raider in double figures. The Lady Maroons have now extended their winning streak to 20 games and will meet the Mount Pulaski Lady Hilltoppers 15-0 on the Jean Vance Court on Monday, February the 9th. Taxpayers could be on the hook for millions in cleanup costs from old oil and gas wells. Study finds thousands of unplugged wells in Illinois pose health and financial risks. Peter Hancock reporting on Capital News Illinois, Springfield. Anyone who has driven the back roads of southern and central Illinois is familiar with the sight of the oil pump jacks that dot the landscape. Decades ago, it was common to see those machines bobbing up and down like drinking bird toys that seemed to operate in perpetual motion, pulling up oil from hundreds of feet below the surface to fuel the region's burgeoning transportation industry. Today, however, most of those pump jacks sit idle, either because oil below has all been pumped out or the cost of pumping what remains underground exceeds what the market would pay. Now, a new report suggests those pump jacks and the inactive oil and gas wells that lie below them are more than just relics of a bygone industry. They also could be environmental time bombs lurking underground, threatening to expose Illinois taxpayers to more than $1 billion in future cleanup costs. The majority of Illinois' 30,000-plus wells are likely producing little to no oil, yet are still not properly plugged, emitting toxic and climate pollutants and threatening air and drinking water relied on by nearby communities, the report states. The report is based on research from the Blum Legal Clinic at Northwestern's University's Pritzker School of Law and the environmental advocacy group Client Earth USA. It says the potential liability facing the state may be much larger than officials have acknowledged so far. But it also says the lack of reliable data about the working status of the oil wells and gas wells in the state, coupled with the state's weak regulatory framework, makes it hard to know the exact size and scope of the threat Illinois faces. Thus, it's nearly impossible to hold drilling companies accountable for paying the costs themselves. The fundamental point is, whatever amount of a problem we've got, it's the industry's responsibility to deal with it, and that's what the system is not achieving, Robert Weinstock, director of Northwestern's Environmental Advocacy Center and lead author of the report, said in a recent interview. Oil and gas in Illinois. According to the Illinois Department of Natural Resources, the history of oil and gas production in Illinois dates back to the 1850s, when the first gas wells were drilled near Champaign. But it didn't become a major factor in the state's economy until the first half of the 20th century, when oil became critical to the modern transportation industry. Since the 1850s, approximately 155,000 wells have been drilled in Illinois, mainly in the southern half of the state in a geological area known as the Illinois Basin, which stretches across portions of Illinois, Indiana, and western Kentucky. According to the data of the Illinois Petroleum Resources Board, a private member-based industry association, Production peaked in the early 1940s when it averaged more than 100 million barrels per year. It dropped significantly after the end of World War II. Production rebounded somewhat in the 1950s and 1960s with the development of new technology like water flooding and hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, which enabled drillers to squeeze more oil out of expiring wells. But it has been on a steady decline since then, with production dwindling to just over 7 million barrels in 2024. Still, according to the IDNR, there are more than 23,400 oil and gas production wells operating in Illinois, although the agency identifies most of those as stripper wells that produce less than 1.5 barrels per day. The agency also lists 6,535 injection wells that store salt water and other fluids associated with oil and gas production, plus another 1,078 gas storage wells. According to the Northwestern and Client Earth report, precise data about production and well activity in Illinois is hard to verify because the state itself does not collect such data. And without accurate data, the report says, it is hard to know how many inactive wells there are in the state and whether they've been properly capped or plugged to prevent them from leaking contaminants into the air or nearby water supplies. When we tried to look up production data for wells in Illinois, we found there was none, that it wasn't maintained by IDNR, Weinstock said. And those folks at Client Earth said, well, you can get production data from the state agency in almost every other state in the country. What's going on here? He said that realization inspired the research project. It was really bringing that national perspective to Illinois and then realizing just how behind Illinois was when it comes to regulating wells at the end of their production lives. Cleanup responsibility. Under Illinois law, the responsibility for plugging oil and gas wells and cleaning up the sites at the end of their productive life rests with the well owners and operators. IDNR is the agency assigned to enforce that requirement through regulations. Recommendations. The report offers several policy recommendations aimed at ensuring the oil and gas producing industry is held responsible for those costs rather than the public. Those include requiring producers to report more data to IDNR so it can more easily identify inactive or abandoned wells, and calling on IDNR to be more aggressive in enforcing laws that are already on the books. It also suggests actions that could require legislative changes, such as increasing surety bonding requirements, repealing laws that allow companies to declare wells temporarily abandoned indefinitely, and restricting the ability of companies to transfer permits to other entities and then file bankruptcy protection to avoid paying cleanup costs. It's hard to tell precisely what corporate entity should be held responsible. Then the question is, who's going to have to bear those costs, Weinstock said. Should it be everyone in the state and the state's coffers, or should it be the industry that still operates those wells? Officials at the Illinois Petroleum Resources Board declined to comment on the report. There was one obituary today. Jerry S. Farrell. That's F-A-R-R-E-L-L, DeWitt, Illinois. Jerry S. Farrell, 61, of DeWitt, passed away at 10:55 a.m. on January the 28th at Westmoreland Hospital in Greensburg, Pennsylvania. Services with military honors will be conducted at 11 a.m. on Monday, February the 9th at Calvert Funeral Home in Clinton, with Pastor David McBurney officiating. A private family burial will be held at Evergreen Cemetery, El Paso, Illinois, at a later date. And I'll leave you today, hoping you have a good rest of today and a great week, and I'll return next week see you then.